Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and a pastor at Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest this week is Susanna Cass, one of the co-creators of the children's game, The Epic Fail Game. A friend of mine brought my attention to Susanna, and of course, because of the nature of the game, I was hooked. Susanna and her co-founder live in Sydney, Australia, and are, in their own words, quote, two reforming helicopter parents with a few decades of professional experience in cultural psychology and design between us, unquote. The game is a set of 30 activity cards and a mindset theory book designed to change the way the whole family thinks about failing. Susanna talks about how the game came about, their experience of putting the game on Kickstarter, and what it means to help your children fail well. Also, just a quick heads up, there is a movement around the world of these, what I call anti-TED Talks, and it's F-up nights, where people come and talk about their failures, except they don't say F-up, they use the swear word, and that's mentioned a couple times in the podcast, so be aware of that. Hope you enjoy it. Well, Susanna Cass, thank you so much for being on the Failing Boldly podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I was really tickled when a friend of mine sent me information about the Epic Fail Games. So, of course, I have to just first start about, tell us about the game itself, and then begin to tell us a little bit about how it started.
Sure. So, the Epic Fail Game, it's an activity-based card game that sets out challenges for the whole family. So it's designed for primary school age kids. So in Australia, primary school age is, I don't know, it's the same lingo in the US, but it's sort of 5 to 12 year olds. But it's really designed to be fun for the whole family. The only reason we put an age on sort of from 5 is because we're expecting the kids to be able to read the cards. The cards were designed with quite simple language, so children can get involved and read the cards out loud. But if they're too young to read, then there's no reason why those cards can't be read out to them. Essentially, the cards include challenges that are fun, but each sit with a rationale that helps to guide parents specifically in how to support children failing and enjoying doing so. So, I mean, I guess the analogy I always say is once I have a dog, I have a great little terrier. And when we first got her, I had no idea how to be a dog owner. So we had a dog trainer come over and train the dog. And we did a whole program and then she went away and we didn't follow any of her advice. And we went back to zero and we had a different dog trainer come who is much more overt and said on the outset, look, I'm a dog trainer. I don't train dogs. I train humans. So that's kind of where we came to after a long way around, is that really this game is about helping kids enjoy failure, but we're not training kids. We're training parents, because a lot of what we're trying to, the anchor that we're trying to sort of shift is in how we parent, and myself included. So this is so... On our website, I describe myself as a recovering helicopter parent, because my journey kind of came through years of thinking I was an awesome parent with all the reinforcing support and finger painting and cuddles you can imagine. But the reality is, I was removing every barrier from my child's path and therefore removing the opportunity for them to really fail and learn from that failure. And so it's really around, the game is really a toolkit for parents to understand different fun ways they can put failure in the path of their kids' upbringing and create opportunities to learn from that failure as well. So how you might talk about it, how you might sort of find ways both within the game and also in day-to-day life to bring up these different ideas or philosophies around failing.
Was there an aha moment for you when you said that you thought you were an awesome parent, but then you realized that you were taking barriers away when you really needed to leave them up so that your child could experience failure? Was there an aha moment for you, or was it more of kind of a gradual recognition that I maybe need to be start parenting differently?
No, there was definitely, I'd say there were two aha moments that happened in my parallel lives of being mother, but also as being a, working in a career as a change professional. So, and they happened along, I'm not really sure which one ticked off the other. I suppose the most forceful one was that my son at the age of 4 developed anxiety. Hmm. And it wasn't like he was suddenly just demonstrating a little bit of nervousness around jumping off a swing. It was really like one day to the next, I went and picked him up from preschool and the carer said, oh, you know, Monty's had to go to the, say this on radio. Sorry, Monty, when you're 21, you're going to hate me, but he's he needs to wee like a lot. Like, okay, well, I'll keep an eye on that. And I brought him home and I thought, okay, well, what's that? He's had a few too many drinks. But he was like, he'd sit at the kitchen table and then need to go do a wee. He'd go do a wee, come back, sit down. And before he could even start eating again, he's like, okay, I need to do a wee. And he's back and forth like a pendulum. I thought, well, that's not right. So we called a visiting GP, which is like a doctor, general practitioner. And he came over and he said, okay, well, he's got a, you know, a UTI or infection. We'll just give him some antibiotics. We did a test. Turns out, didn't have that. We then had, I mean, this was, in the meantime, this was driving us crazy. Like, I can't even tell you. He was all night, all day.
But I want to just make sure that the translation is correct. You mean like he had to urinate all the time, correct?
He had to urinate all the time. Okay. He had to wee all the time. And it's like we'd get in the car and I'd have to pull over on the freeway. It was driving him crazy, but it was driving me to my wit's end. I didn't know what to do about it. So we had him going to ultrasound. We had him checked for diabetes. We had, like, I can't tell you all the tests we did. We saw a urinary pediatric specialist. And in the end, the results came back that it was psychological. Mm. That effectively he had developed an extreme anxious response to something, God knows what, and that when your body is that small, the anxiety tenses your muscles and it feels like you need to wait, but you don't. That wasn't the aha moment for me that the parenting was off. It was the moment that I met our cognitive behavioral therapist, or pediatric cognitive behavioral therapist. That's a mouthful. But in that process, it took about 6 months of going to see this lovely lady and reading a lot, because that's my default. I guess I do a lot of research. I read books that led to more books that led to more books. And that was rewiring your anxious mind to the coddling of the American mind, or, you know, the link started to reflect obviously multiple possibilities of how and why a child can suddenly become anxious. But a big part of it, which is I always tell my kids, you can't control what other people do, but you can control yourself. I can't change the whole world and the way, you know, society is structured to influence our children, but I can change my part in that. And so I started looking into specifically, you know, the influence of helicopter parenting and that sort of notion of, well, there's lots of different words, I suppose, snowplow parenting or lawnmower parenting, where you run ahead and you remove the obstacles. And I start recognizing small things like, you know, the reward chart we have on the fridge, where we give them a gold star every time they do something right, or we sort of overpraise our children's amazing artworks or not. But the way that we do so, I also recognize that while I had this one gorgeous little boy with overt anxiety symptoms, I also had this amazing daughter who is a hyper-perfectionist. You know, she would draw the same picture over and over again because we've told her it's awesome. So, you know, she doesn't want to disappoint us. So she just keeps doing the same thing. And and when you start to see those realities manifest around you that you read about in the articles and the books, you start to, you get a clue, right? That, you know, maybe the way that I'm speaking, or the guides I'm putting down for my kids are not really helping them. They might be hindering them. And then I guess in parallel, because I worked as a brand strategist at the time, I was working for this organization. It's a big sort of telecommunications organization here, and they they rebranded, and it was a bit of an aha moment when the CEO came to us and said, okay, well, we changed our brand, you know, 4 months later, but our people aren't becoming more inventive. I want them to be more creative. And it's like, well, you know, giving yourself a new look and feel isn't going to change the way your people behave. They're still being rewarded for walking the line. No one's being rewarded for trying anything different. You know, they created this innovation hub, but they put it across the street in a different building so that, you know, if anything went wrong, it wouldn't affect the brand. And that's when I came, am I allowed to say fuck up nights? You can edit that.
Sure.
That's when I came across, you know, from an industry perspective, the appetite for a different way of managing people, or a different way of rewarding staff. So I went to Fuck Up Nights independently, but through that network that I developed, I started to see and read case studies of organizations across the world who have monthly rewards that go to the teams with the biggest fail or the most inventive fail story, and then also meeting people through Google, who have a very interesting framework or system for using failure to learn from. It's an all failure, so it's logged in a database, so you can go and you can check other people's failures. So before you embark on a project, you kind of understand what's been done before and what pitfalls to avoid, because ultimately failing, you know, it's great in and of itself, of course, but it's only really valuable if you learn from your mistakes. So it's how you kind of create structures around that as well, so that you're mindful of what you've done, you're mindful of what variables you can influence, what you can do differently next time, and you clock, you know, the effect of those changes that you apply.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm rambling.
No, that's fine. How then you're taking in all this information, and I would imagine you're beginning to maybe put it into practice as a parent. And then, so how does the whole notion of, Yolanda is the co-creator of the game, correct?
Yes.
Were you friends before? And then the two of you started talking about this, sharing notes, and then—
Absolutely.
Was there a moment where you thought, oh, we need to create a game?
Yes. So Yo and I have worked together for many, many years, but I had left the organization where we worked together for a while, and this all happened in terms of the anxiety and the workplace epiphany, and I came back to working with Yolanda, and when we were talking about this whole thing, it turned out she had a similar experience with her son in terms of experiencing more nervousness and anxiety, and we decided to, because we were sharing materials, information, you know, all the materials I was reading and articles I was sharing with her, and she was sharing stuff back to me. We were looking for something that we could share with our kids. So it started off just thinking like, well, what kinds of messages, and wouldn't it be great if we could give them a different North Star, if you like, because so many of the books and the posters and the things that we read and the movies that we see, it's now it's starting to change, thankfully. But previously, I mean, the stories that we read, it was really around striving for success or beauty, or, you know, especially on a princess level, but that's a whole other thing. So wouldn't it be great if we could create a resource for kids that had different messaging, you know, that celebrated failure and focus less on success and focus less on looking good and being seen to be cool. I mean, I know those things are sort of biologically ingrained. We're not going to move away from that as such. But I think that, you know, with social media and that tide of expectations heaped on the kids as well, we kind of need more content that shares an alternate view. And so we'd started developing, we couldn't find anything, frankly, that we thought was what we were looking for. So we thought we'll have a go at developing it. And when we first started developing it, it was much more of a therapy kit for kids. Mm-hmm. It was about teaching them or repackaging a lot of the material that we learned about resilience and giving them almost exercises to do and diaries to keep and things like that. But when we started to test it with kids and with friends, it was really hard because it's a bit like telling your child that they should eat more broccoli because in 30 years' time, their cholesterol is really going to benefit from it. So you don't want to tell your five-year-old, oh, you're going to fail, it's going to suck, but trust me, in 30 years' time, you're going to be so employable. Right. So we thought, how are we actually going to make this fun so that kids actually want to play it, and then we can teach them failure in stealth, right? So they don't even know that they're learning it while they're doing it. And the game changed through multiple iterations. We had groups of friends with kids test it. We had educators. We had a lot of primary school teachers test it with classrooms and with their kids. And we had psychologists test it. We had, I have a great, a friendship coach that comes to our school and teaches friendology. She gave it a test run as well from a social perspective. And
I'm sorry to interrupt. What is a friendship coach?
Oh my goodness. I can't tell you.
That may be another whole other podcast.
Yeah, it's a whole other thing. I'm going to have to introduce you to her because you'll love her. She's Canadian. Okay. And she's, she comes to this, well, she taught a curriculum at the school based around social skills. So it's called Friendology 101, but essentially it teaches children to recognize toxic friendships and how to have conversations and how to negotiate bullying, or she doesn't call it bullying, she calls it mean on purpose, but how to sort of take ownership of your own social skills, which I also think is weirdly lacking and kind of strange that in some ways that we need to teach that at school, but it is something that doesn't happen as organically as it used to, perhaps when we used to all play on the streets and encounter strangers more frequently. Hmm. But yeah.
Sorry, that was just, that came topic, up and it just sounded so intriguing.
Yes, absolutely. Well, yeah, no, I'm a big fan. So so it has gone through a few iterations until it has landed where it is now, which is a set of 30 cards. Now, I'm going to have my memory tested here, but I think 20 of the cards are designed to be played around the table with family, and the other 10 cards are designed to be taken away from the dinner table in terms of beginning to introduce the notion of failure into everyday life. So we start taking it. The children can do it on their own or they can be prompted by their parents, but it's starting to show how they can apply the simple, the thinking behind some of the challenges into just everyday activities.
And then, so what, once you finished the game, or you had it tested, and was that when you made the decision then to take it to Kickstarter?
Yes, I suppose. We once we had the game fairly well designed, we started to research what it would actually cost to get it up off the ground and how we might fund that. And we had friends who recommended Kickstarter, and I hadn't done any kind of crowdsourcing before, so we pulled that together and got it up off the ground, and we got great support. So we did manage to reach our goal, which was incredible. And we have printed our first run. So that happened just before Christmas. We have just received the first batch of the game. And if you supported us on Kickstarter, you would have received your games just before Christmas. And then we went into a bit of a hiatus and a recovery mode. I think it was all such a big rush to get to the end of the year, not least because we're both working full-time jobs and have children. So doing this as a side hustle was a labor of love, but it was very, very exhausting. So we've both now enjoyed a bit of a summer holiday as it is here in Australia, although it's been a bit of a crazy summer. I don't know how much you've heard on the news about the east coast of Australia.
Yeah, with all the fires.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So it's been a bit of a nuts summer, but yeah, we're planning to kick back in early this year and work on distribution and marketing and all the nuts and bolts that come with launching a product.
Were you surprised? When you put it up on Kickstarter, how confident were you that you would hit your goal?
Look, I think that's a really tricky one, because in some ways we're thinking, you know, it's nice, whatever we get will be appreciated, but whatever we don't get, we'll work out how to get that money down the track. So we didn't really expect to hit the goal. I think it was almost...
Sorry to interrupt, I was, for people wondering, the Kickstarter goal was about $30,000 Australian dollars, which is about 21,000 American dollars. Yes. I did the math before the podcast. it sounds like you're pretty committed to doing it regardless.
Yes.
But it was a pleasant surprise that you actually hit it.
Yes. Yes. So we got picked up by some media here in Australia as well. So that helped. We got on, we had some articles written about us on some kids podcasts, kids blogs. And, there was a story on a morning TV show as well that gave us a plug. So we got a little bit of, reach that way. I also reached out, just on LinkedIn, because again, I'm not that awesome with social media. So that was a big learning curve for us as well, as actually getting our presence out there and talking more. And the story I put up on LinkedIn was really how the experience of two introverts trying to start a business, because both Yolanda and I absolutely hate talking about ourselves. So this was always going to be an interesting challenge once we got the game done, because the design part, the creation of, or the pulling together the research, so that was our sweet spot. This next phase will be a very interesting way for us to practice what we preach in some ways, to kind of step into the unknown and embrace whatever failures we will probably encounter.
I'm curious about the so once it became both the promotion for the Kickstarter that you got in different avenues, and as people are hearing more about it, I'm first curious about responses from other parents. Have they, for the most part, been receptive? Have there been any who push back at all on the notion of doing this?
No. Okay. So I should say, though, with that in mind, I don't want to just be partying in my own echo chamber. The people that we've spoken to, of course, have been very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm conscious that, you know, if you're not going to support it, we probably don't know you.
Right.
I don't know. It's a funny one, because in some ways I do appreciate that this is a slipstream that I've been caught into, and it seems there's a lot of conversation happening about failure and about specifically helicopter parenting or the future for or how we prepare our children for this sort of unknown future, right? That's a big conversation in Australia within education, our policy making, and how we prepare children for jobs that don't exist yet. And so that's starting to become a mainstream-ish conversation within education streams. But I don't think that actually, if you haven't had an experience or an aha moment or a wake-up call in any kind of way, that this would be on your radar specifically. Mm-hmm. If you don't happen to work in organizational change, or if your children are perfectly, you know, anxiety free and, you know, operating as expected or what you think is normal, then this probably wouldn't have crossed your path. So in some ways, I think I've spoken with parents who've raised an eyebrow and gone, oh yeah, I can see where you're coming from. Oh, right. Put you on a shelf. And others who've really leaned in and gone, that's so interesting. I've noticed that reaction with my kids too. And I also got a phone call the other day from some mother asking me to invite their kid to our party and all this kind of like behavior. But I haven't had direct pushback. My only, I mean, concern, and I don't know what you found as well, Christian, in your travels with your podcast, is that it's really about growing the pie, as we say in the industry. It's really about sort of creating the problem, but throwing a light on the problem before you can sell the solution in some ways. Because if a lot of people don't know that there is a problem, and you know, for a lot of people, it might not be a problem. I'll be completely frank. I mean, maybe people, I'm sure there are some incredible parents out there who are just, who just do this naturally, who are just old school and just have always supported their kids failing. And, you know, like this whole notion of letting their kids run free on the streets and play with hammers. And, you know, that could be completely the norm for a lot of people. It just wasn't for us. We just kind of, I think, just our lifestyle, we hadn't quite recognized how much had changed since we were kids.
I find a lot of folks who are, I'm 51, and so I hear a lot of people reminiscing about their childhood in, say, the 1960s or 70s and 80s, and just are, it's remarkable, and I say this too, is like, we were just given free rein to do whatever and go wherever and no questions asked. And that's such a change to today. And I think people are still wrestling with that. Like, on the one hand, of course, you want your kids to be safe, but I think there's a little bit of remorse that my kid is not enjoying that free rein that I had.
Yeah, absolutely. And I watch old movies now with my kids, and they keep looking at me going, yeah, but where are their parents? How come they've been gone for 3 days? I'm thinking about Stand By Me. It's like, how come no one has asked where they are? Like, what it used to be like, I guess. I mean,
yeah,
that's what it was.
What on the Kickstarter page, you talk about, and you've already talked about how it was tested by a lot of adult experts. But on this Kickstarter page, you also talk about how kids have tested it too.
Yes.
So I'm curious about what have been responses, especially in the final iteration of the game. I assume that kids have found it to be fun. Do they also talk about, are they able to unpack the whole notion of failure and what it means and how it can be helpful?
No, I think kids have found it fun. I think interestingly, like when we started testing the first iterations of the game, failure had a very different, it was a bit harsher and a bit harder. It was sort of more along the lines of go to the shops by yourself and pay with the wrong and without any money and try to pay for something, and or you know, go to school with the wrong uniform on, and that kind of, it was pushing the boundaries to a point where kids were like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah,
like I'm uncomfortable with that, I'm too embarrassed. And really it made me realize as well that, you know, and our psychologist friend came back and said, look, if this meets a child with anxiety, you can break them. And it made me reflect on, you know, having to go to, I don't know if you have them, what they're called in the US, or, you know, hens parties where you go and you have to wear some ridiculous outfit and you're out in public and you feel like an idiot. And I think, well, that's not really failure. You don't learn anything from that. You just feel bad and you feel ashamed and you wake up and you're happy it's over. So we didn't want that to be the experience of the game either. So we, through feedback from kids in those scenarios, shifted the tone of the game a lot and made it a bit younger as well. But yeah, feedback I've had from kids who've played it since the game has gone out has all, it's been fun. It's been mostly all hearing about what their favorite challenges were. And I don't think the parents have really sat down and explained the theory behind the game, but I don't think that's even remotely necessary. I think that's kind of for the parents to know and for the kids to experience. So, I mean, my kids have obviously been marinated in all the theory, so they find
Have you noticed any, and you may not be comfortable sharing, have you noticed a change in your kids' behavior since you kind of started this whole journey?
Look, I think, I mean, they, are so hyper-conscious of this this track that I'm on that, you know, we kind of joke about it. So yeah. I give them no space to back down from anything. And when I when my daughter says like, "Oh, I'm no good at that," I just have to look at her and she's like, "Yet." She's like, she knows what's expected, and I'm, you know, but you know, I talk a big game in theory, but I'm still working on it myself. I still sure. have to let my kids, I still have to step away when I know they're, yeah, going through uncomfortable social situations and things. I really have to, I still am in training all the time, conscious of what I let them do.
Yeah. And I have found too, it's just, especially as my kids get older, when I put myself in a position to fail, and my kids can see that and they watch how I respond to it, that can be really helpful. So for example, my son has gotten really into climbing. So he'll go to climbing gyms, and that's been really, I have hardly any experience at all. So I went with him a couple of weeks ago, and he's, you know, doing these walls and challenges much greater than I can. And so I tried like the just beginning level, and I'm falling down. I'm complaining about how hard it is. And it was embarrassing for me. But then in reflection, I thought, you know what? It's probably really good for him to see me do that and to fail in that way.
Absolutely. Which is one of the biggest shifts when we started making this game. And like I said before it was like a therapy kit for kids. And now it's a family game. And one of the big aha moments in that transition was actually, it is really important for kids to see vulnerability and to see you practice what you preach. So if you mm-hmm. want me to look like an idiot, then I want to see you look like an idiot too, right? So that's right. why the game has become around, like everybody does the challenge. You know, everybody has to retell a story or draw a picture with their feet so that we can all laugh about it together. And then I think when parents begin to let go of this idea that they have to look like superheroes all the time in front of their kids, it makes for a difficult role model to live up to, right? So you kind of have to show sometimes your own soft underbelly and your own failings. And that as well has opened up different conversations for us as well. Like, I mean, I entered a film festival competition at my workplace a year ago, and like, I don't mind saying I totally blitzed it. It was awesome. And then the film festival came around again this year. And my instinct was like, well, I don't want to do it again. Cause like everyone was sort of asking what I was coming up with. Cause last year was so great and I had nothing. And and frankly, it just was like, I wasn't going to do it because I wanted to end on a high. Mm. And I got bullied into doing another submission by my kids. And this time around, I did not win anything. It was rubbish. But to be fair, like, what kind of standard would I be setting if I just had to, if I let my success stop me ever trying again?
Yeah.
So yeah. Instead of doing it collectively and being open about that and being open about your fears and what you're nervous about and when what your disappointments are when things don't, you know, turn out the way that you want them to.
You may have just given me, I normally end these conversations by asking someone to share a fail story. So do you want to use that one as your story, or do you have something
sure,
else in mind?
Sure. No. That was perfectly fine. Okay. Like, it wasn't a complete fall on my face fail, but it was definitely a bit of a moment when nobody asked me after that film festival. It's like, nobody's asked me again. What my plans are for the next one. It's like, okay, right. But I often think, you know, for me, growing up, like when I'm starting to put it together, because I look back and I don't remember having anxiety. I was a shy kid. So I think, you know, if it's genetic, then I don't completely discount that side of it as well. But it's, but I spent a lot of my school life, I suppose, not trying as hard as I could have because I was afraid of being seen to fail. Like if I didn't try and I didn't succeed, at least I know that I didn't try. So I could talk myself into that sort of comfort. But I remember once that when the shift happened for me, God, it was way late. Like I probably was 20 or something when I went skiing for the first time with a group of friends who ski all the time. And so I was off at like beginner's class while they were all going down the mountain. And we met up afterwards at the bar. And they said, how'd you go? And I said, oh, I did really well. I didn't fall over once. And they all sort of scoffed at me and said, well, if you didn't fall over, you're not trying hard enough.
Mm.
And that was the first real click for me. That I thought, oh, well, that's an interesting perspective. And they then spent the whole night just talking about their biggest crashes and their biggest, you know, injuries and failures. And it was a whole different tone that was set, you know, that was almost this fetishizing, challenging yourself. So you're getting to your inner best, which I think, I won't say it changed me completely from that moment onwards, but it certainly set me on a different kind of path where I have more conscious conversations with myself around mm-hmm. what I'm comfortable with doing and pushing myself in different ways.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. So if people want to know where and how they can buy the Epic Fail Game, is there a timeline at all that you hope to have this available?
Oh, no, it's completely available now.
Oh,
you go to the Epic Fail website, which is www.theepicfailgame.com.au, there's a shop button and you can shop away.
Well, Susanna Katz, thank you so much for being on this podcast.
Christian, thank you for having me. That was great fun, and best of luck with everything moving forward.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Susanna for giving her time for this conversation. To learn more about the Epic Fail Game, you can go to theepicfailgame.com.au, and you can also find them on Instagram and Facebook at The Epic Fail Game. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com. Please consider subscribing to this podcast via Apple Podcasts or Spotify. My next conversation is with Tim Hillegons, the author of the recently published memoir, The Distance Between. Thanks again for listening.